This episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast is being brought to you by Loot Crate. Listeners, if you're looking for gear, collectibles, housewares, or more from your favorite pop culture franchises, then look no further than Loot Crate. Loot Crate offers a wide range of geek and gamer items for less than $20 a month. $20 a month! What more could you ask for? Well, if you want to take it to the next level, you can get a bigger box with even bigger loot with Loot Crate DX, or if you're the type of person who likes to wear your geeky heart on your sleeve, Lootware is the monthly wearables and accessories subscription that you've been looking for. That chill running up your spine isn't your imagination, dear listeners. It's the Loot Crate October theme horror. Horror. Loot Crate is taking over 40 years of creepy, campy, bloody icons and putting them in this month's crate. Channel your best final girl with items from The Walking Dead, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Halloween. Now, if you want to get in on this horror themes box, you have until the 19th, 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific, to subscribe and receive this month's crate. If you miss that 19th deadline, you're going to miss the cutoff. You're going to be out. You're going to be gone. The Loot Crate is going to be gone for good. So make sure you head over to lootcrate.com/spoilers. That's lootcrate.com/spoilers. Enter the code spoilers and save off any new subscription today. Thank you, Loot Crate, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Boo.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans. No, really, seriously, it is.
In this issue, it's going to be a real hamdinger of a show as we discuss the big Wonder Woman news, talk turkey about everything under the sun, and use our logic brains to word punch things in a goodly type manner. We got Resident Aliens, Witches on Wheels, Crisis on Infinite, Kurtz, all this, and Civil War 2. You can't buy this kind of entertainment just anywhere, so throws the rings and get your lady friend a Cupid doll, because the Major Spoilers Podcast is hitting the midway full of terrible carnies, and it's on the air.
Welcome to issue 697 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everyone, for sharing this podcast with a friend, because without you spreading the good word, putting positive reviews over there on iTunes and all the other places that you listen to podcasts, we wouldn't be able to grow. So it's up to you to make that happen, and we thank you for all of your big help. Ashley is here this week. Hello, Ashley.
Hello, Stephen.
You are about to head off to New York Comic Con.
I sure am.
Are you packed and ready to go? You get to spend, 5 days in New York City?
I'm taking a backpack, so yes, I'm
packed. Right. Bet you're pretty stoked for that, right?
I am. I'm not stoked for the flight, but I'm stoked for the being there.
Nonstop, or do you have to do changeover somewhere?
Nah, if that, nonstop.
Ooh, cool. Nice. Yeah. Gotta love that. Matthew is here. Matthew, what's going on with you?
Well, I'm not going to Comic-Con, but if I play my cards right, I might convince somebody to watch Say Anything with me.
I see. Yeah. And then there is Rodrigo.
Hey, I'm not watching that movie or going to Comic-Con, but I had a pretty decent sandwich earlier today.
Well, you can't beat that, I guess. Maybe Comic-Con beats a sandwich.
What was on the sandwich?
Yeah.
It was tuna. And mayo.
Well, mayo pickles.
And red onions.
Okay.
He's anti-pickle in his tuna, as I recall.
Lettuce, green peppers, and tomatoes.
I can do everything but the tomatoes. Good. That's not too bad. I would throw pickles in instead of tomatoes. I don't know if that beats first class nonstop to New York.
It's not first class.
Well, I'm just saying, it doesn't beat first class to New York.
Ashley's riding with the luggage in the back.
I could fit.
I just like
it's a DC-3 turbo prop.
You know, in movies where they just do a smash cut to like a the protagonist like riding a bus and there's like chickens on the bus and stuff.
Yes.
I just assume that just like happens in planes that are like really cheap.
it's like one of those Airbus ones. So like I'm in the middle of the middle, so it's definitely going to be like that.
Is that going to be like a regular bus?
Are you sitting next to two people that are at least enjoyable?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
He does not know them.
They're strangers.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You friends.
We will find out more about all of Ashley's adventures in the big NYCC next week on the Major Spoilers Podcast. But until then, let us get to some news. Wonder Woman is bi and everyone is freaking out. Green Lanterns and the Planet of the Apes crossover has been announced, and a new Batman movie is titled simply The Batman.
The Batman.
Let's spin that wheel of destiny. Let's see where we land. I hope it's on Batman, because that's a non-news story.
It's not on Batman.
Story right there. Oh, look, it lands on Wonder Woman is bi, and everyone is freaking out. Now, I don't know, maybe that title is maybe a little bit of hyperbole, but it certainly seemed last week when issue number, 5 of Wonder Woman appeared on the stands, and it confirmed that, I guess in this iteration, that Wonder Woman is bi. So many people were having a problem with this, and I'm trying to figure out why, because Matthew, if I'm not mistaken, hasn't she always been that way or had some sexual fluidity?
Here's
those
the
people
thing.
In the horse they rode it on.
here's the thing about it. It is not that she wasn't bi. It is that a lot of times you have to code messages in comics in the 50s and the 60s, even going back to the 1940s. There are things in there that definitely support it. There are things in there where you can just go, yeah, that's 100% obvious from what they were writing. And if you know things about Dr. Marston and his beliefs and his personal life, then it is not by any means a stretch to think that it's intentionally there. But the problem is, in 1945, there wasn't sex in comic books at all. There was no sex to be had. Even, I mean, Superman didn't sleep with Lois Lane. They just chastely kissed, and then she would, you know, go back to scheming to find out who he really was. So it's one of those things where if you're bad at subtext, and this is some of it really obvious subtext, then it is possible to have read Wonder Woman and never caught this. I can tell you that the first time that I saw it explicitly in a book was in the 1980s. It happened in Justice League Task Force
Perez
in the 90s.
Perez
even War? Before that.
Oh, okay.
Perez was 87. It was actually
in the Perez
that.
Stuff, though.
Yeah, it's definitely in Justice League Task Force, where Wonder Woman actually tells her Justice League comrades, well, they don't call it Paradise Island for nothing, when they asked about her dating with no men on the island.
Earth One Grant Morrison story is like that too. Like they're just like ogling her as she's nude at one point.
Right. And Morrison intentionally went back to call out the subtext of those old Marston stories. And I don't know if you could say rightfully so, but definitely obviously so. And, you know, they have textually stated it in comics a number of times in the modern era. This is just the first time that somebody's had a press conference.
I'm just wondering, who are these people that are so outraged about it? I have a theory on who the people are that are outraged.
Bunnies?
It could be bunnies. But Rodrigo, who is freaking out about this and why are they upset?
Well, the first I saw of it, I looked it up online and it said, Wonder Woman is bisexual, DC Comics confirms on Maxim's website. And that is so far the most surprising part to me, that Maxim's even still around. But I think there's a lot of reasons why people would be upset. And it mostly has to do with the officiality of it, right? There are people who don't want politics in their entertainment. And for some people, the sexual orientation of other people is politics. So it's not just prudes, right, that don't want any sex in comics, and it's not just, homophobes that don't want any gay sex in comics. It's also maybe, you know, slightly more lenient people who are like, oh no, now there's politics all over my comics. Mm. I came here to watch a lady tie up monsters and then stab them. Like, why is any of this happening?
Ashley, you have a lot of thoughts about this.
I have so many thoughts on this.
Where do you want to start?
I want to start by quoting something that Jason Inman said that I think is very fabulous.
Okay.
He said, isn't it wonderful that Paradise Island is not supposed to be paradise, it's utopia. In utopia, everyone is happy, everyone gets what they need, and everybody is fulfilled. And isn't it a wonderful idea that in utopia, everyone can love whoever they want, however they want, and not be persecuted for it. And frankly, icky white dude behind his computer, if you're threatened by the fact that maybe I could kiss Wonder Woman too, then your problem lies with a fictional character and yourself, yeah, and not with the story being told.
That is exactly the thing that I was thinking about, I think, earlier this week or last week when Matthew and I were talking about this, is that I think it is white guys are the ones who are angriest about this, because in the fantasy mind, I'm not saying this is the way with everybody, but in the fantasy mind, the man is sitting there fantasizing about, yes, I'm going to get with Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is going to get with me. And Steve, I can just push him out the invisible jet, and it's just going to be me and Wonder Woman making out in the invisible jet.
Or I'm Steve, really.
Right.
Oh, right. If you're wanting to do that fantasy replacement. But the minute that you
goes
introduce...
on you, because Steve is going to go read Midnighter and Apollo this week. Yes.
But here's the thing. The minute that you introduce the fact that Wonder Woman is bi, then you have this problem of, oh my gosh, just like you said, and like Jason said, what if Wonder Woman decides that she wants a woman over me? Suddenly my masculinity is threatened. Suddenly I don't feel as great as I thought I once was, that I have to compete with a girl for Wonder Woman's affections. I mean,
well, Nicholas Scott, current Wonder Woman artist, posted a picture that she had drawn of Steve, where he's obviously looking at Diana with some affection on his face. And she was like, look, guys, Steve just loves her more. And I thought that was a great lesson to take home.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I heard this and people were angry, I was like, it clicked on me. The only group of people that can be angry about this are single white men or white men in general.
Yeah, it's such a bummer because, I mean, like Matthew was talking about when we started this conversation, like it's been subtextually a part of Wonder Woman from her inception, and it's really not that subtle most of the time. Even in the current run, when she leaves Paradise Island, she kisses this woman on the cheek who she's been holding hands with and has her arms around. Like if you're not picking up on what that physical cue is just because they're not lying in bed together and someone writing an article for you to, like, that's on you. And maybe you like need to observe humans a little bit more. I don't know. But I think it's, on the one hand, it's really great that it's blown up this much because it's a lot of great press for a pretty good run that's on right now. And it's focused on a character, and it is giving, you know, a group of people that feel marginalized, one of the greatest heroes of all time, someone to look at. But it's sort of terrible that this is a giant news piece because it doesn't matter.
Well,
like,
that's kind of...
Who cares?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is, really? I mean, who cares? And then you're like, okay, well, wait. For people that are marginalized and underrepresented, this is that official statement that, you know, that they can... love Wonder Woman.
That it's okay.
That
yeah.
it's okay to have Wonder Woman as their favorite, even though they probably, you know, the groups probably did already see Wonder Woman as representing them. This, I guess, makes it a little bit more official. So I can understand it from that point of who cares or why is this a big deal? But from the whole point of this has been going on for years, guys, you're just now catching on to this, makes me kind of
disappointed.
Yeah.
It's that thing where we feel an ownership of those things that we love. And I think that everyone at this metaphorical imaginary table has had a moment where a creator has done something to a character or has revealed a different side of a character or written a story with a character that doesn't feel authentic to what we feel that character should be. So I understand the impetus. I understand the reason why people are upset. I think my big issue with this whole thing really comes down to, A, it's not new, and B, just the fact that somebody made a big deal about it doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to be a huge change to everything you know and you have to throw out your Linda Carter poster. I mean, the Wonder Woman character is, like all of the big iconic characters, meant to be elastic, meant to be something that anyone can see themselves in. And it's that same thing that people complained about. I mean, we've seen this before with Miles Morales is now Spider-Man. People complained. Steve Rogers is having some sort of plot point. People complained. They shot the Hulk in the face. Nobody seemed to care. But what it really comes down to is...
He's not a hot girl, Matthew.
I don't know.
Yeah, but some people freaked out when they thought She-Hulk was dead.
Well, and I was upset when I thought She-Hulk was dead, but I was only upset in that metaphorical sense that she is lines on paper and not a human being. What it really comes down to for me is if more readers are able to see themselves in the character of Wonder Woman, then I am fine with alienating those people who don't want to see that aspect of Wonder Woman. Because frankly, what it really comes down to is when we look at specifically the DC universe, and we've seen, you know, the return of a lot of characters and the death of a lot of characters who were designed specifically to give people something where they could see themselves, your Ryan Choi's and your shuffling off the field of your Jaime Reyes. And you see these things happen, and it feels like you are really stacking the deck in terms of everybody needs to be a white guy from the 60s with a buzz cut. I'm really sort of fine. In fact, I'm 100% fine with saying that Wonder Woman has that fluidity. Wonder Woman was raised by woman, by all women, on an island with all women, who for thousands of years have lived with other women. This is a natural, understandable, and perfectly logical progression. Frankly, if you're 12 and 13, that's probably the thing you go, you know, how does that work? Oh, well, they're all women. Okay, that's fine. So
you can also go onto the internet and find out how that works pretty quickly, too.
Nope, no internet. I have a 12-year-old. There's no internet.
Safe search.
Safe search, and I'm turning off the Wi-Fi.
On the plus side, as you're mentioning other groups that are being represented, Justice League added some more characters to their roster in the coming months. The Atom Ryan Choi is coming back.
Nice!
Vixen is joining the Justice League. She's already been on there. Mario Kane.
Ray's back.
Yep. And Killer Frost is also joining, plus many, many more in the coming months. But I'm really excited to see Ryan Choi come back.
Which Killer Frost? Is it Caitlin?
Let us see. It is.
I would assume so based on the
that's my assumption.
Popularity of Flash.
There are like 9 Killer Frosts.
Ooh, it's interesting.
Like,
you'll have to look at the image. I'm sure it's her. I'm sure it's Caitlin.
Yeah.
But in the description, they say the Atom. Meet Ryan Choi. Vixen. Here's Mari McCabe. Ray. Here's Ray Terrell. And then Killer Frost. What happens when the supervillain is in the last days of prison at Bel Rev? Yeah. Okay. It doesn't say who she is outside of that. So
wasn't Captain Cold already on the league?
I don't know. I haven't read Justice League.
I think what
in a
this means is if you're a villain and you got ice powers, you're in the Justice League because we need ice for our parties.
There's
Green
just
Lantern
like way too many.
Somebody's got to cool down the Captain Atom when he starts to overheat, when his coolant
Captain
runs
Atom
out.
Captain Atom is not in the league.
He should be. Dang it.
He hasn't been in the league for 20 years.
Since he blew up last time.
He's been on JLI a couple times.
Captain Atom.
Look at the brains on Ashley.
I will give her credit for that. But yeah, Captain Atom was in Extreme Justice. And that's the last time he was in the league, bro. And that was like 1997.
They make fun of Extreme Justice. They made some dope-ass action figures of that.
Extreme Justice. All right, I will make fun of Extreme Justice. And you know why? Because I can.
Mm. Extreme Justice was really beefy.
Yeah. Extreme.
Was that,
it was like
that's the best description ever.
Who was the main
Mark
artist on that?
Sears.
Was that who it was?
No, the Extreme Justice series had several different artists, but they were all extreme.
Well, yeah, even because even the Flash had some extra streaky streaks on his costume. Or no, I'm thinking of
Of Justice League Task Force.
I'm thinking of Task Force.
Total Justice was if you can't say anything nice.
Says the guy who was just making fun of Extreme Justice.
I did not make fun of Extreme Justice. I said Extreme Justice like that. And I let you make the extrapolation.
Okay. Thank you, everyone who listens to this show. You can show your support by heading over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. As we are recording this episode, depending on where you live in the country. Hello, future people. It's already happened to you.
Yeah.
The Flash Season 3 premiere is happening. Flashpoint is going on right now as we speak. Some people have already seen it. He hasn't sent me a screener. But there we go. But hey, this is the good thing. If you're a patron member, if you're a Patreon member, you're going to get the new season of Flashpoint coming your way. It's the Flashback podcast that Matthew and I do.
Flashback
is the podcast. It's coming your way. Yeah. coming this week. Yeah. So head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers and get in on the action with the season premiere. First episode coming.
My name is Barry Allen.
And if you're so inclined to find out more about the new Batman movie and what its potential title might be, you can head over to majorspoilers.com. You'll find all of those news stories or non-news stories. So much more. Majorspoilers.com. Let us do some reviews.
I'm sorry. That's just such a non-story.
It is. Like, I don't know if you guys, did you guys watch the video where they're interviewing Ben Affleck? Did anybody watch
it? I was at that junket as that happened.
Oh, okay.
Someone yelled it in the hall and we were all like, yeah, obviously.
So he's just sitting around. He's like, yeah, we're thinking of calling it The Batman. That's the title that we have right now. But, you know, we may change it. But yeah, right now it's The Batman. It's like, well, duh.
I like Ben Affleck, though. It was so funny. It was so understated.
I
like,
know, right. And the internet freaked out.
Yeah. Well,
what's the bigger story? Wonder Woman is bi, or the new Batman movie is currently titled The Batman?
They're both like just not important at all.
Such clickbait material just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
The new Batman movie thing is just so dumb.
I know it is.
It's like, you know what they're calling the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie, Steven?
Dead Man's Chest.
Dear God, Pirates
of the Caribbean : some bullcrap.
No, it's Dead Man's Chest. We got a trailer up there on majorspoilers.com. Yar. You can go check it out. Now to some reviews. Ashley, what do you have with us this time?
Dead Man Tell No Tales.
Dead Man Tell No Tales, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a comic book.
Yay.
The Dark Horse.
Yay.
Because someone on Twitter said that I only review DC comics.
No.
Which is only mostly true.
Right.
So... here at Major Spoilers, we awesomely get some stuff really early. So really early, we got a copy of Spell on Wheels #1, which is a book written by Kate Leth and drawn by Megan Levins, two people who I really, really like, about a bunch of witches doing cool witchy stuff and going on a road trip. So this is pretty much tailor-made for the Ashley comic reading experience. So there are three ethnically diverse witches. We have an Asian witch, we have a nice white redheaded witch, we have an African-American witch, and they all work together and they all have different kind of witchy powers. And you see somebody break into their home and he's like stealing all their junk, and you don't really know why he's stealing their junk or whether it's important. When they come home and they discover that he's stolen all of their junk, it goes really badly because it turns out he stole the second most important thing that they own. And I'm trying not to spoil too much of this book that doesn't come out for another couple weeks yet. The basic premise of the book is that to go and get all their junk back from witchy eBay, they're going to go on a road trip in a magic witch car, which they sold their magic witch mystery machine for, and get it all back based on where witchy eBay told them the buyers lived, which is a really funny, really cute, like current Archie style comic story. I think this first issue does a really good job at setting up why we are meeting these particular witches and what the restraints of the world are. There are a lot more Wiccans with actual powers as opposed to your Harry Potter type magic witches. Tarot is a thing. They use crystals. They use summoning circles. So it is all very, in as much as possible, reality-based urban fantasy, which is great. And also very prevalent right now, but it doesn't take itself so seriously that there aren't a bunch of really awesome puns and jokes. I've read a lot of Kate Leth's stuff. I think this is some of her best writing to date. I'm really excited to see where it goes. Unfortunately, this issue is all set up, and while it is very interesting setup and all the characters are very unique and you can see the intricacies of their relationship and their working lives, like, literally, the adventure doesn't actually start until the last three pages of the comic. I feel like it was more of an issue zero than an issue one, but, like, only big two books do issue zero, so this is issue one. Megan Levin's art is amazing, as always. I'm a huge fan of hers. It's nice to see that there is a male character who's pretty prominent throughout this first issue. She draws a lot of ladies, and she draws them very well. But fans of her work in Buffy will know that she can also draw some pretty strapping dudes. So that's really fun to watch as well. And it's a very vibrant color palette. So it's definitely like fun, witch road trip adventure style, as opposed to like, this is Greg Rucka and Nicholas Scott's like black magic and it's all gritty and dark and people are going to die horribly in a witchy fire. So I would say that if you are in the Halloween spirit all year long, like myself, if you like urban fantasy, if you like Ladies in Charge, if you like really cute art, Spell on Wheels, number one, is a great issue. It's shaping up to be a really fun first arc. It has a pun in the title. What more could you want? And I just think it was really great. And it's like coming out in time for Halloween. So just hunker down, wear your witch hat and pick it up. And I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5 of the slices of the meatloaf. So I would have given it 5. But like I said, there's only 3 pages of like actual premise of the comic.
Cool. Check that out. Coming out from Dark Horse Comics in what? 2 weeks? 1 week?
The week of Halloween.
The week of Halloween. So in a couple of weeks, people, be on the lookout for it. You know, Ashley, a lot of people accuse me of just reviewing number one issues.
Yeah.
And that's, so that's true. I'm going to go ahead and review Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York, number one, from Boom Studios. And
hey, high five, number one club here on Wednesday.
Yeah, there you go. This is written by Greg Pak with art by Daniel Bayless. And for people wondering, how the heck does Snake Plissken and Jack Burton hook up together? Well, I'm about to tell you.
Fight, 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 kiss, kiss, kiss.
Yes, yes, and they're the same person. So Jack is driving his truck through Texas in 1987, talking about how awesome he is, as he also always does on his CB, with Lopan's ghost sitting next to him throwing curses at him, when suddenly a portal opens before him, and he goes whipping through time and finds himself in the Marauder territory of Okla, Texas Range 2001, and it's Mad Max scenario, and he's driving his big truck and he chases off these marauders and everyone thinks that he's Snake Plissken because he looks just like Snake Plissken. And his good buddy Wang Chi is there too, although only it's not Wang Chi. And then mayhem ensues and we find out that Wang Chi, or this universe's version of Wang, is actually a lawman. And he tapped into the government's mystic archives trying to get Snake Plissken to come to his aid. And so he asked in poor Mandarin for Snake Plissken to come his way. And he got Jack Burton instead. But of course, now that Jack Burton is impersonating Snake Plissken, Snake Plissken wants to get involved because now there is a bounty on his head. So they show up together and they decide to team up to go save a precious artifact. I won't tell you what that artifact is. And hilarity ensues. So they've taken a concept of how do you get Kurt Russell and Kurt Russell from two different franchises into the same story. I think they've kind of done it, although it did take a lot of explaining to get there. It's not a horrible story. I think the art is maybe a little goofy, especially when they're drawing Jack, as he appears a little bit fatter and a wider chin than the Snake Plissken character. It is what it is. And if you're expecting some highbrow adventure, it's not that. If you're expecting silly, goofy humor injected with post-apocalyptic 2001 United States, this is exactly what you're going to get. It comes out this week from Boom Studios, and I'm giving it 3.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. It's cartoony fun. It is what it is. It's exactly what you think it is. But I know a lot of people were wondering, well, how do these two team up? Magic. So there you go. Yes. It's interesting. I think you would enjoy it, Matthew. At least as much as I did.
I'll probably see it eventually.
At least as much as I did. Now to put a buffer, an even further buffer, between our Dark Horse reviews. Let's get to Matthew.
Hello. My name is Matthew. People accuse me of reviewing whatever the hell I want. And that, my friends, is what I do. So this week, Captain America Steve Rogers, number 5. Actually, I think it came out last Wednesday from Marvel Comics. It's got a big Civil War II thing on the cover, which means it might have something to do with Civil War II. I want to point out that not every book that does have anything to do with Civil War II, so let's see what happens. Written by Nick Spencer, art by Javier Pena. This is continuing the storyline that Steve Rogers in the 1920s was actually secretly basically indoctrinated into Hydra, the evil guys who are evil. of the Marvel Universe. And this story actually introduces something that really confuses me, in that one of the Hydra dudes he meets when he's a tiny, tiny boy in the 1920s seems to be Dr. Faustus, who grows up to be one of his villains in the modern day. I guess he's immortal. I don't know. This story switches back and forth in time so much, you guys. We start in 1926 with baby Steve Rogers, and then we have the modern day where the Red Skull is doing something, and it basically summarizes the first four issues of Civil War II. Essentially, this is the book that brings Steve Rogers' continuity up to speed after the first four issues establish the new premise. And in that, I think, is the biggest weakness of the book, in that a lot of it is recap. Now, I have been reading the core Civil War II title. Reading is probably not the right word for it. I have
been looking at.
I've experienced those books. And, of course, I've experienced the Civil War, the Accused, and Civil War, the Myrtlecated. And throughout all of those books, there are differing takes on what's really happening. In a way, that's good because, you know, adult conversations sometimes have different sides to them. This story predicates that behind the scenes of all that, Captain America has been doing sneaky evilness. At one point, Ulysses, who is a kid who can see the future, who is the one who started the whole mess, is about to be murdered by Captain America. When we see a scene that happened earlier where he was almost about to be murdered by Iron Man, and then Medusa said, no, go home, you can't. So basically, this is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, our Captain America, for the first four issues of Civil War II. And it builds to a point where we find that Steve Rogers may have actually set up Bruce Banner's murder. And Steve Rogers may be a secret manipulator behind all of the things that are happening in the Marvel Universe.
No, say it isn't so. Not Steve Rogers.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't really jibe with what I've already read.
And the thing about it that is very important is Steve, as an agent of Hydra, is actually after one important thing. He wants to myrtleize the Red Skull, who is the leader of Hydra. So I'm...
Isn't it so much fun and confusing when you can have storylines like this?
Well, part of it is that, and part of it is it's a Nick Spencer book. And Nick Spencer likes for everybody to have lots of hidden agendas. If you've read Nick Spencer's work previously, he's really good at the wham line. You know, he's really good at things. Yeah. Morning Glories is like 50 issues of Everything You Know Is Wrong. But when you really get down to it in a shared universe, it becomes more problematic. I will say this. He is one of the writers who does not make me hate Carol Danvers during her actions in Civil War II as they are seen in this issue. That's a good thing. He doesn't make me hate Tony Stark Iron Man either. He does make me hate Steve Rogers, but I've hated Steve Rogers for a little while. It's something that just sort of comes around and goes around. But what it really breaks down to is, this book is a series of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And the overarching bits of story aren't really stitched together all that well. It really feels like they've gotten to a point in their story where they're like, okay, I can take a breath. I have a whole bunch of exposition to get out, so I'm going to talk really fast and get the 30 minutes of stuff, you know. Or, you know, at the end of a commercial where they're like, and buy now, not valid in all 50 states. It feels like that. It feels like they're jamming in as much as they can to make sure that the story that they're telling in Captain America Steve Rogers stays up to speed with Civil War II. As such, I can't necessarily recommend this as an excellent book. Very well drawn. If you are not on board with the concept of Steve Rogers, Agent of Hydra, this is not the book that's going to disabuse you of the notion that it's not good. But there's a lot of potential here that doesn't really quite get to the page in a way that makes for a single readable issue. It definitely feels like that third act of a larger story. And as such, I go with 2.5 slices of meatloaf. there's a lot to like here. There's a lot to dislike here. And I think what it's really going to break down to is if you're buying this Steve Rogers is always a Hydra agent thing, then this will be a solid issue for you. If you're not, I wouldn't recommend this. There's nothing here other than some secret that affects Civil War II one way or the other. So far, this may be the big issue 2 months down the line that changes everything forever.
Interesting.
Yeah, I said forever, and then there was the implicit ...
Oh, okay.
Steve Rogers' life will never be the same again.
I'm sure it'll never be the same again sometime. I don't know. It's a different...
Way to kill a joke, man.
I know, right? Let us get to Rodrigo, then, with his book.
Hey, I'm Rodrigo, and people accuse me of having 3 reviews to come up with a thing that people accuse me of, and then just kind of not. So this week... This week I'm picking up Resident Alien, The Man with No Name, number 2, your and my favorite story about a purple alien just kind of talking to people. The oddly compelling adventures of a small-time doctor who just happens to be an alien. So in this issue, the doctor goes and has dinner with the dad of his assistant. That's what happens in this one. Also, they investigate a fire, and they see that there may be a drug ring involved. There's actually a lot more concurrent plot lines in this one than there have been in prior arcs. Especially the Sam Hain mysteries, which really just seemed to be about one thing and didn't really seem to have a lot going for it. This one has simultaneously there's this drug stuff, there is the CIA basically getting closer and closer to him, and then kind of the personal stuff going on with the doctor. And you know, I like Resident Alien a lot. It's super interesting how they managed to kind of continue this very small story involving space aliens. There is one problem that I have with this issue, which is something that I hadn't quite caught, and this issue really brought to the fore, and I'm a little bit concerned about it. There has been, other than random people that weren't really impactful, there's really only one person who can see the titular alien for what he is, and that is his assistant, who is just happens to be Native American. And then in this issue, we meet her father, who is also Native American, who can also see him, and talks about his daughter and him being a little different from other people. And it just kind of struck a weird chord, you know? It's it was kind of oh, maybe it's 1 in 1,000,000,000, however many people can see him for what he is. But it's oh, are they going to make this a mystical Indian thing? Because that would be terrible. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. But other than that, the story continues. It's pretty interesting. Art is great. A big fan of it. This is a comic that has a lot of perfectly mundane looking people, right? It's not, there aren't mechs or robots and dinosaurs and guys with triceratop heads or anything like that. It's all just normal people, and they're all very distinctive. They're always drawn. You know, you never confuse the sheriff with the mayor, with the nurse, with anybody else, right? Everybody looks, is very well designed. Everything is very cool. Other than that slight, bit of concern, this is a pretty strong effort. So I'll give it 3 slices of meatloaf for a Resident Alien, The Man with No Name, and number 2.
Excellent. There you go. Listeners, head over to majorspoilers.com. A whole lot of reviews popping up over there. You can check them out. Major Spoilers. While you're over there, you might want to take a look at that one ad that we have on the side for Tweaked Audio. They've been sponsoring us for years. Of course, we've been talking about them for years, and so many of you are finally discovering the awesomeness that is Tweaked Audio. And best of all, when you check out Tweaked Audio and you enter the code MAJOR at checkout, you're going to get 33% off those earbuds. Hey, Halloween's coming up. You need something to give out to the kids in the neighborhood. Stock up on some Tweaked Audio earbuds. Hand them out. You will be the savior of Halloween. I don't get to say that often, but you may be the savior of Halloween this year. If you head over to tweakedaudio.com, buy a whole bunch of earbuds to hand out to your trick-or-treaters, and you're going to save 33% off by using the code MAJOR. You guys watch any of the Luke Cage yet?
Oh, yeah.
Matthew, have you?
Not yet, but I'm familiar with the story.
Okay. What about you, Rodrigo?
Because it's called the first 10 issues of Luke Cage.
I haven't gotten a chance.
Well, as I'm watching this, and I'm watching what Cottonmouth and his cousin are trying to do, and the kind of the connections
Mariah.
To Kingpin. Mariah is her name. That's right. It got me thinking about villains with a capital V and just, you know, villains with a small V kind of thing. Because what do you do when you have a villain that wants to kind of do good in the case, rebuild Hell's Kitchen or bring up the affordable housing in Harlem. But in order to do that, they have to have lots of money to do that. And so they're going to turn to nefarious deeds to do that. Is that still a noble cause or is that just a bad thing? Is it wrong for someone to steal bread if they're feeding their family? I guess that's what it boils down to.
Well, I don't know if that applies to the Kingpin's actions in Daredevil.
Well, at least that's what he is.
I don't know if that applies to Mariah
not
either.
Not necessarily Mariah. I mean, that's what she says. That's the talk that she's saying. Or at least as far as that I've gotten through this story. Now, she may have something else up her sleeve. But what about these villains that are trying to do good, but in order to do good, they have to, or in order to do something that will better the populace, they have to do bad things?
See, you get in a really weird area because then you get into that argument of, oh God, what is his name? I can't even remember who it is now. But the whole plot was to save the world from overpopulation and starvation and hunger, he was going to destroy one quarter of the population.
Oh, you're talking about Ra's al Ghul.
I think I'm talking about a half a dozen different people.
Yeah, you are.
But what it really comes down to is that question of, for instance, if you look at the Punisher, and what I know, if the Black Mariah arc goes the way the Black Mariah arc did in the comics, which is to say silly, I think what it really comes down to is that ancient argument of the ends justifying the means. And comic books, at least, are kind of predicated on the fact that they don't. Yeah. And
right. It becomes a difficult question when you view it through the lens of like real life.
Right.
And that, you know, this is the same argument that we get to, like with Civil War II, where it's like, we are raising very large concerns in a real world context with sociopolitical aspirations. But you are still going to blow the whole thing off with a big explodey fight. And one of the heroes is going to end the conflict.
One of them's going to die because it's a Marvel event.
Right. But whoever wins is going to be the person who wins the fight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you get to that point where, okay, let's say Kingpin. Kingpin wants to do something good, but he has to kill a bunch of people to do it. And the only person who can stop him is Power Man. And Power Man's going to beat the snot out of him. So
10 out of 10 would watch that.
Right. I would too. Especially if it was actually Vincent D'Onofrio getting beaten up by Mike, what's his name? Because that guy is
Coulter.
Like, I love him. He's awesome. What it really comes down to then is it not necessarily like a gimmick, but is it a hat on a hat? Like the Ra's al Ghul thing. Ra's al Ghul wanting to kill a huge chunk of the population doesn't feel like he's wanting to do good necessarily. Whereas if you look at the, you know, that Kingpin thing, I don't feel like what he was doing was for the greater good. I feel like that was the smokescreen he was putting up so that he could, you know, basically get away with whatever he wanted. If that makes sense.
Rodrigo, you have some, Ashley, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's what I feel like Mariah is doing. And I haven't come to the end of her storyline yet, but it feels like there was a good intention there. And mm-hmm. then the corruption, which is very deep-rooted in that character, really takes over and like comes to define who she is.
What episode are you up to?
Seven or eight.
Ah, okay.
The one where a really important character bites it.
Okay.
It was the last one I saw.
Okay.
Is it Luke Cage?
Is it Luke Cage? It's totally Luke Cage, isn't it?
I'll tell you though, I will never get sick of seeing him wearing a hoodie and the bullets just bouncing off. Yeah.
It is really
cool. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's really good. I like this show for a lot of different reasons. But just to see him take those bullets or two, you know, there's this real, and I'm not going to, this isn't a big spoiler, but I'll say one thing. He's trying to help a girl who has had something that's been stolen and she's ready to kill people. In fact, she shoots somebody earlier in one of the episodes because she wants this thing back. And Luke Cage shows up at a church where she's going to shoot somebody. And he sits down next to her and says, "You don't want to do this." And he quietly squeezes her purse. And he gets up to go say what he needs to say. And then she sees the guy that she wants to kill. She reaches in her purse and she pulls it out and it's all crumbled and smashed up because he's super strong. And it's like, wow, what a great little, you know, that's a great little moment in the show. But overall, I've been really pleased. I just finished episode 5 today. And I'm really enjoying this. This is one that I kind of want to savor. It's kind of like with Daredevil in that I'm okay with watching one episode a day or one episode every other day to kind of stretch it out because I want to savor every moment and think about the themes and the messages that are being sent out there in a lot of places and a lot of different themes. And as opposed to I've got to watch all 8 episodes of Stranger Things in one afternoon because I got to know what happens next. So it's a good show and I would encourage people to go check it out. And if you are not wanting to watch Luke Cage because he doesn't wear a tiara and a yellow silk shirt, I got news
for
you.
Wrong.
You're absolutely wrong. He does wear a tiara and a silk shirt in this show. So there you go.
Yeah, but like for half an episode is a joke? Or
no, not half an episode is a joke.
It's not a joke.
It's an important part of the story. Yep. I got a text message today from a friend that I knew in high school. And let me call it up here real quick, because I want to get this right. She says,
"It's a long distance dedication."
Basically.
Oh my God.
She says, "Hey there, looking for some cool Red Hood comic books. Got any resources to share? My boy is crazy hooked on Red Hood." And my first reply is, first of all, you're the worst mother in the world. And second of all, Red Hood is the worst.
Well,
that's the problem,
boy.
Because her son is the same age as my oldest son. So Mason is 9. So he's 9 as well. And so,
oh, no. Give him Robin your 1 and tell him that it's Jason Todd.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so first I said, first of all, Red Hood is the worst. And before you buy that first trade paperback of Red Hood and the Outlaws, you probably want to flip through it because it is definitely PG-13. And knowing your son through our Facebook interactions, this may be a little bit too much for him. I said,
also
not a great story, right? but I did say, you know, if he's keen on the idea of Jason Todd as a hero, even though he's kind of a dick, well, go back and look at him when he was being Robin. Go back to the 80s and read some of that stuff if you're really interested in it.
I mean, that's like as nice guy Jason Todd as you're going to be able to get, because after that, they really sink their teeth into like he was the misfit
him.
Robin, which sometimes, like in my opinion, in a story like Under the Red Hood, can be really effective. But for the most part, it just makes him a douche canoe.
I have a feeling that I didn't probe to say how did he find out about Red Hood, but I have a feeling it probably was the animated series, the animated Under the Red Hood.
It's
not
actually
like a kid's movie,
possible
though.
That, it's possible that it was the Arkham games because I think he shows up.
Oh, he's pretty significant in there.
Yeah, that could be it too. But I think she's the kind of mother that would kind of say this probably is not appropriate for you. I think she's a smart mom. I think she's a smart mom. I've known her for years. So, but are there any? Let me just put it this way, because I said you're a bad mom, and Red Hood is the worst. But I said, here are some potential things. What are some other potential Red Hood stories that maybe a 9-year-old might be appropriate for a 9-10-year-old to read?
He shows up in the episodes of Teen Titans Go where Robin calls his team of Robins to him. Because every incarnation of Robin is there. And that's a pretty inoffensive, kid-friendly version of him. I don't know this 9-year-old, but kind of depending on how sensitive your 9-year-old is, Batman and Robin Eternal is pretty Jason Todd heavy, and it focuses a lot on his functioning relationship with Tim Drake as, like, Batman, like, Robin bros. And he's not, like, a massive bag of dicks in that. However, there are violence aspects of Batman and Robin Eternal that I would see.
I would probably be okay with my son reading Batman and Robin Eternal if he had any interest in it. So that would probably be okay. Rodrigo, do you have any ideas? Or Matthew, do you have any ideas?
Boy, I don't know about Red Hood and the Outlaws, but the Red Hood and Arsenal series seem to be a little more centered and a little less.
Red Hood and the Outlaws gets a little, juvenile. Shall we say, rapey in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. But Red Hood and Arsenal, when they take Starfire out of it, part of that DCU relaunch a couple years ago, wasn't all that bad. There's a Red Hood and the Outlaws annual that I feel like is adorable, but I don't know if. I mean, Jason,
one?
Yeah, Jason isn't necessarily a character who's had a lot of, you know, really, really giant arcs. And if you actually read his story in order, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because he jumps back and forth. You know, his villainous run when Dick and Damian were doing the Batman gig is great up until the point that you realize that immediately after, somehow he de-ages by like 5 years and does a face turn. But
don't worry about it. It's comics.
Lazarus.
Well, man. I do worry about it. Missy, I've been reading comics longer than you've been alive.
Batman Year One is a good Dick Grayson tale. And it's also I think it doesn't. Isn't there a big arc?
You mean Robin Year One?
Yeah, Robin Year One. Sorry. But I still think you might have a lot of fun just reading maybe the first 12 issues of the Tim Drake Robin.
I would say if
he's fighting King Snake.
A Lonely Place of Dying into that first Robin miniseries into his, you know, when he moves and gets his own car and hangs out with Spoiler. That's all good stuff. But again, that's not Red Hood. And
well, I'm trying to figure out why a sudden fascination in a young kid with Red Hood.
Because he's a bad guy.
But is he popping up somewhere besides that Under the Red Hood animated movie? Is he popping up on Teen Titans?
And that movie's from like 2000.
Yeah, but it's on the Netflix or whatever someplace. I'm sure they see it.
He's had his own book for the last 5 years. I mean, it's possible that he just ran into the comics.
I don't know.
Is he in the Lego games?
He might be in the Lego games. There is a Lego minifigure of Red Hood in, it's one of the sets that came out just before Suicide Squad that had Red Hood and Harley Quinn and Batman and Deathstroke? No, not Deathstroke. What's his name? Deadshot. It's Deadshot. In that set.
He's got that cool costume.
It is
like
a cool
Batman
costume.
Beyond suit with a leather jacket and a Daft Punk helmet. I mean, it's a good look, and it's easy to see how you might get interested in that character based on current stories or the visual or whatever it is, because, I mean, half of my love of certain characters is the fact that they have a cool, different-shaped visor than the rest of the X-Men. So, I don't know. If it's something that's out of the comics, I would definitely recommend that second arc, not Red Hood and the Outlaws, but Red Hood and Arsenal.
Okay.
Has he had a solo book?
I don't think so.
Only a mini series.
Red Hood Solo Cup.
I get
it. Rodrigo, any thoughts?
Not really. This is not a character. It's really not a character I follow.
Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, why would you? I mean, he's horrible.
We could be making this all up. I mean.
We're Rodrigo, yeah,
have you read
quietly gaslighting
Rodrigo?
Have you
read the latest issue of Crimson Shadow?
Yeah.
Crimson Shadow is great. It's about this guy. His name is Ted Ward. and he has the power to like melt into shadows and come back out.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's good. You'd love him.
What is on your mind this week, Rodrigo?
What is on my mind? So I was talking to people at work yesterday, actually, and one of the guys at work who's like, he's like 20, was like, what is you guys' favorite classic movie? And I'm immediately like, oh, well, definitely Battleship Potemkin. But he, so after exactly the response that you guys just gave me from them, he's like, mine's The Breakfast Club.
And I'm like, classic.
Right?
Classic, and I'm like, 50 years or older.
Well, exactly. That's my question. How old does a movie have to be before it's considered a classic movie?
Yeah, it's really...
Now, to him, right, if he's 20, that means The Breakfast Club is ancient. I mean, The Breakfast Club is actually slightly too old for me. It basically came out, I think, the year I was born.
Mm-hmm.
But I still wouldn't consider it a classic movie. So even in my own brain, I'm like, how old does a movie have to be before it can be a classic movie?
It's
I'm just
tough.
Baffled that he thinks that The Breakfast Club, which reduces all of its characters to stereotypes and is responsible for some of the most denigrated teen storytelling that we have now, that's being lauded by someone as a classic.
You can't blame The Breakfast Club for like even worse imitators, right?
It's like, no,
it's really not
The
not
Breakfast
its fault.
Club for Judd Nelson. Yes,
I mean it's cute. But
the thing about The Breakfast Club is it feels iconic because it's a movie that came out before him. I will, and not on this show, at length be happy to argue the merits of The Breakfast Club with you. But I think what it really comes down to for me, when I think a classic movie, it's almost always something that came out before I was aware of movies. Like not necessarily before I was born. Because I was born in 1970. There are movies 1975, 76 where I'm like, oh, that's a classic. Jaws is like a classic movie to me. Mm-hmm. Or American Graffiti.
Mm.
But I think what it really comes down to for me is it's one of those things of a classic movie is something from before my frame of reference. My frame of reference kicks in right about 1978, 79. So anything before, let's say, The Black Hole can be a classic movie to me at the age of 45.
And The Black Hole kicks off modern cinema.
Exactly.
It's it's the last movie that had
a traditional overture. So it's really a capstone on the classic age of Hollywood. It's the last and greatest Hollywood. Holy moly, the sky just opened up. Sorry. The last of Hollywood's great giant films.
Yeah, the elder gods from out of space know you're crazy and they're coming to suck you away. That's right. So when you look at these kind of words with classics, it's really weird because when we think of an antique, in a definition, it depends on what we're talking about. An antique is something that's over 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about vintage cars.
Which film has barely touched,
right,
by
exactly,
the way.
Right. When we talk about vintage cars, we're talking about cars that came out from 1919 to 1930. That would be considered a vintage car. A classic car is something that is over 25 years old.
Right.
Or 20 to 25 years old, because I know that there are some cars that are, you know, late 1990s. In fact, I remember seeing an Impala 2000 model. Recently that I remember seeing brand new that is now considered a classic car. So if we go by that definition of a 20 year old, 25 year old run of something before it's considered classic, then he's not maybe off from what he might be considering a classic movie. I think from another standpoint is where does that movie or where does that item stand in pop culture? Because you have some things today that come out and people are saying, hey, this is an instant classic.
It's a modern classic.
I hate this new Disney movie is an instant classic.
Right? You have people saying that. But they're saying that, I think, from the perspective of it's not 20 years old, but it is something that, from a pop culture or cultural perspective, has something that will ring for generations.
Right. Something that feels timeless, enduring, classical. Like, people started calling The Little Mermaid, a classic Disney film, right after it came out and right before people discovered the phallic symbols in the cover of the VHS box. But I think that that is justifiable in certain situations. But again, it's an eye of the beholder thing. I mean, I have friends who think that Chicago, the Richard Gere, Catherine Zeta-Jones Chicago, is a wonderful classic film. And I, you know, I understand it's enjoyable. I liked it. I really like some of the performances in it. But I don't necessarily know that I would call that a classic film. But films of that same vintage, films of that same age, I might make that argument about. What year did that come out? Like 1999 or something?
Well, see, you just use vintage too. And vintage just simply refers to something that came out at a specific time period, like a vintage wine.
I used it as a time frame.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. When we talk about wines, when we say a vintage wine, it's not like a wine that's 20 years old. It's a wine that came out during this period or that was harvested and bottled during this time period. So
a contemporary film rather than a vintage film.
So, I mean, I think it's one of those words mean what I want them to mean, no more, no less kind of things.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. I think that's what ends up happening is there's this, there are these movies that are seen as timeless that are very old. Right. And, you know, calling movies that you like that are maybe slightly or significantly younger classics is kind of an attempt for you to like canonize your own movies, right? To say like, you know what's a really, really great, really super great movie? Balto. Balto belongs in the pantheon along with, you know, His Girl Friday and
A Clockwork Orange.
A Clockwork Balto National Lampoon's Van Wilder in the pantheon of movies.
Well, you know, sometimes we'll say something or do something on this show and they'll say, "Oh, that bit that you guys did, it was a classic major spoilers piece."
Well, and that's the thing is like it really depends on the scope of it, right? It's like how many episodes are we on for Major Spoilers?
679 issues of the Major Spoilers podcast. No, not 697. Holy crap.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot. And especially by podcasting standards, that is a lot of episodes. But, if you look at the entirety of film history or the entirety of human history, it is but a blip. So, but definitely a bit that we came up with, eight episodes in that we're still using by our standard. Yeah, exactly. That would still be a classic.
Yeah. Well, and again, the thing about language is always mutable. And when you have, especially when it comes to movies, the amount of puffery that you see when people say this film is a modern classic, that's not necessarily always someone, you know, assessing it as a film, that may be someone trying to pitch you to go and see the freaking movie.
A PR move. Is that what you think it is when you hear instant classic or modern classic, Ashley? Is it's a PR thing?
I think that now that I work reviewing movies, but I studied English in university for a long time, so using words properly and I understand colloquialisms is very important to me, and I remember vividly a teacher who was like, people who go around saying this is an instant classic or this is a modern classic are giant babies. And that has like so hard stuck with me. And like, it drives me insane when people use classic to describe something that's like not over 50 years old. Like, it hurts me in deep, dark parts of my soul. And like that's just what
in 4 years,
on
I will be a classic.
Oh, I there will. You go. A classic human being.
Yes.
Blissfield. You know what's a classic movie? Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Is it?
Yeah, 1971. That's a classic.
I don't know how long ago. 50
well, that's
years
not was. Quite 50 years,
man. My math is bad.
It's 50, I didn't
50
say
years
it was
would be
50
like 66.
Years. I don't agree with the 50-year time.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I was saying earlier timeline. About. You know, sure. When you say certain things like an antique has to be 100 years old, something that's classic or something that's vintage comes from a particular year, certain things have to be at least 20 years old before they can fall into this category. I honestly think it has to do with where it falls in popular culture. And if it,
but
and
when
if it is
those,
stuck around.
We put all kinds of restrictions on people based on years. So, like, why can't we do it to movies? And books and stuff.
Because we'd have to sit down and agree on it. And if this panel is any indication, that is hot.
Yeah, we are four people, and we have more in common than a lot of groups of people might in terms of our perspective on things. But even so, there are moments where you'll say, oh, The Breakfast Club is terrible. And, you know, my inner 70s
kid. I didn't say it's terrible. I said it's not a classic.
Not the point. My inner 70s kid wants to rise up like Gary Oldman as Dracula and hover outside your window until I, you know, drain all the blood from that terrible theory or, you know, make a bad metaphor and or simile. But
I'm on the second floor, so.
It's cool.
Oh, man. Coppola's. Wait.
Vampire?
Was that Coppola's Batman? Yeah.
Dracula.
Or not Batman, but Dracula. Dracula. Yeah. It's like, what a classic.
Coppola's Batman. How weird Coppola's Batman be?
Do you feel like we missed
Coppola's
out?
Coppola's Batman. I do want to see Coppola's Batman.
I'm
like, but is Batman now or his Batman when he was a classic?
Coppola after...
Classic Coppola?
Yeah, like classic,
or classic
Coppola.
Batman. See, if you're doing classic Batman, it has to be 60s circle Batman.
I think if you're talking about classic Coppola and you're talking about classic Batman, he would probably do like a Detective Comics 27 story set in the olden days.
So.
Amidst the rise of the gangster.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Cameron Crowe's Batman.
And you would see all of his greatest vintage of wine in the background because he owns a vineyard now.
Yeah. Cameron Crowe, what Batman would he do, Matthew?
The Cameron Crowe Batman? Ooh, that would be tough. You remember that pitch that went around for Batman High School? Where all of the villains and Bruce Wayne were going to high school
almost
together.
Batman.
That one that almost happened as an animated series. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, that one. That would be the Cameron Crowe Batman to me. Sort of Fast Times at Gotham High. You play it straightforward and you have like, you need a point of view character that can't be Bruce Wayne. You need like, I don't know.
6-year-old Dick Grayson.
No. You need something like Tommy Hush. Who is his nerdy friend, right?
The Eddie Haskell.
He's like, no, he's more like Rat from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He's the nerd in the midst of it all. And then you have all the stories that revolve around him. And at the end, he finds out that his friend is actually Batman. That would be the Cameron Crowe Batman for me. Either that or like 90s kind of proto grunge Batman. Where you do like the Scott Snyder Batman Year One as though it took place in the Eddie Vedder, Kurt, what's his name, era.
I think
you
want to
say Busiek. I know you do.
I think he would want to be telling a story about a lovelorn Batman and his love for Silver Sable or something.
Silver Sable?
Or whatever.
Silver
St. Cloud. There you go. Yeah.
Silver Sable. That's cool too.
That would work too.
No.
Yeah. Crossover.
No amalgam. Amalgam Rodrigo, is not classic.
Pick a well, let's see. Who should pick a director? Ashley, you pick a director for Rodrigo, and he would tell you what Batman story that one would do.
See, now I'm on the spot. I can't think of it. Alexander Caron.
What did he do?
He did Birdman and the one good Harry Potter movie. He's the one who Sean Penn made that awesome green card joke about.
Oh, yeah. No, that is that's where I know him from. You know, because when you're a Latino in the media, you're just like, I'm just sitting there like ordering a burger at a restaurant. And all of a sudden there's like this, like, I just get this feeling and I look into the sky and it's like something racist just happened.
That would be a sick web comic, though. I'd read that.
I think... it would definitely be like, I want to see like a kind of neon Batman, like take that like neon Batman and not make it the Schumacher Batman. Like, I think in that constraint where there's like all of these like colors assailing you and Batman as he's trying to like basically piece it all together in his brain. I think that's a villain, I would say. I'd say let's go back to the Penguin. I think that he could show us like a really fancy, like not necessarily like gothic penguin. Mm.
Okay, Rodrigo, you get to turn the tables on Ashley.
Oh, Lord.
Don't give me John Hughes.
No. What is the...
Wes Anderson.
Oh, man.
Yeah, hang on. I just lost the name. Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright, huh? Well, the cool thing about Edgar Wright right off the bat is that Alfred can be played by Simon Pegg.
Ooh.
Which would be great because it would be like Batman the Animated Series Alfred, who's mm-hmm. like, I drew you a Bath, Mr. Way. And he would turn around and like the easel would inexplicably be there.
Yeah.
I feel kind of the same way that it would be a brighter color palette, but not like 90s color palette. Like it would be a really cool grayscale with highlights in red or yellow or green, like basically your Robin colors.
Mm.
But then that probably means that like Paul Rudd is Batman, and I just can't stand for that. That's just a really
Michael Cera.
Michael Cera would be good.
No,
he's already Robin, and I can barely live with that.
That's true. Yeah,
yeah, that's gonna be weird.
Yeah, like it's gonna be some young hotness guy. Not even like hotness, but like somebody who's very now. Because when Michael Cera like played Scott Pilgrim,
David Cross.
As Batman?
As Robin. Yeah, David as Cross Batman. With his big beard.
David no, Cross you is gotta... Batman and Brian Posehn is Robin.
Wow. But wait, that just hurts me so hard.
Although, let me tell you this.
And he's wearing the classic shorts.
Could you do David Cross as Hugo Strange?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, I was just thinking that.
That is so dead on. That would be perfect.
Yeah.
I have not watched that. I don't think I even watched any of last, maybe two seasons of Gotham when Doctor Strange did show up. Or is he showing up this season? I forget which.
I think Hugo Strange, don't call him Doctor. He's Professor.
Oh, that's right.
But I think Hugo is in the upcoming season.
Ah, okay.
I don't watch Gotham, but I see their trailers so that I can react with derision.
Okay, I'm going to throw out some classic Batman stories.
Sorry.
And you tell me, each of you can tell me who you would want to direct that movie. First up, The Long Halloween, Rodrigo.
The Long Halloween, definitely Del Toro.
Okay. Well, that's good. All right. Matthew?
Tim Burton.
Hmm.
Because Tim Sale draws like a Tim Burton story.
He does. He does. He really does.
Okay. Ashley?
That was actually my first choice. Like, he said The Long Halloween. I was like, that guy already did a Batman.
He did Batman, didn't he? Well, yeah.
You can do it again. Ashley, who would you pick?
I would pick David Cronenberg because I think he'd make a sick, really scary Batman movie.
Good God.
And he's terrifying. Canadian.
Oh, no. Canadian.
And it means that Viggo Mortensen is going to be in the movie. So I'm down for that.
He knows what Batman is about, is what I'm telling you.
Batman's a boat?
Nobody says that except people from the West Coast.
All right, here we go. Now, this may be the exact same answers from all of you. Mm-hmm. Batman Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth, written by Grant Morrison, illustrated by Dave McKean. Now, let's start with Ashley. Rob Zombie from Matthew. Okay. Ashley?
Fincher.
Oh, good one.
I want my Batman's movie scary, evidently, is what I'm learning about myself.
Rodrigo.
Terrence Malick.
That's what I was thinking, too. Yeah.
I just went like halfway through to see the entirety of the creation of the universe before we get back to Batman.
Right. Or have like, you know, the entire history of the Cobblepot family dated back to 1726.
Appropriate, though, for, you know, for your Grant Morrison type story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know it's been an animated series already. I know it's already been animated, but Batman Year One. Ashley, let's start with you this time.
Batman Year One, huh? I would really like to see Batman Year One directed by Stephen Moffat.
Hmm, interesting.
Of Doctor Who and Sherlock.
Why?
He does really good, because he does such good introductions to characters. Like, the first episode of Sherlock is so strong. The first episode where you meet the 12th Doctor is really good. The first episode where you meet the 11th Doctor is really good. And then the first episode of the 9th season of the contemporary Doctor Who, where they reinvent the Ninth Doctor and they actually decide what they're going to the 12th Doctor, I'm sorry, and they actually decide what they're going to do with him is even better. So I think he does a great introductory origin story. So I would like to see him make that leap, and I think he could deal with some of the crazier stuff because nothing's crazier than Doctor Who.
All right, Matthew.
Robert Rodriguez.
Okay. Why?
In his Desperado Once Upon a Time mode.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to see that kind of thing. Even if he went with, you know, his new school, everything on a green screen Sin City thing. I hated Sin City, but I thought it looked fabulous. And I thought that it was fascinating mm-hmm. to look at. And if it were just not, you know, Sin City, I think I would love that movie 8 Ways from Sunday. So I'd really like to see a take on that on something that doesn't, you know, make me physically ill to watch.
Is somebody having thunder?
Yeah,
in the
it's
background?
Matthew's got a big
That's
storm.
No,
I can hear it. That's
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, yeah. No, it blew up here earlier this morning or earlier this afternoon. So yeah. I knew it was.
I said the sky blew open, man. It's yeah. nasty outside. We're getting hail right now.
Rodrigo, Batman Year One.
Guy Ritchie.
Ooh. Especially right? in those beat right? up scenes, right? With Gordon getting the beat down.
Yeah, nobody does main character got beaten up like Guy Ritchie does.
Well, that's now I'm actually interested in seeing that. I'm thinking about Bruce walking down the street, you know, the first time he's not Batman yet, but he's like undercover mugger and he gets attacked by all those people.
Lock, stock, and two smoking barrels.
Oh, and he's chasing the young Selina Kyle before she stabs him and you've
yeah,
got
right?
the
how great,
slow, fast,
how great
slow
would that,
Guy Ritchie stuff.
Yeah. How great would that chase scene be in Guy Ritchie style?
Mm.
I just feel like there have to be like a lot of turnstiles involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Here's a tough one because I think it's got a political intrigue bent to it. Death in the Family.
Oh.
Wow. Well.
Let's start with Ashley. You've got somebody picked already or not?
I do because okay. this is the one that I'm desperately hoping that we're getting some form of in the Batman. So like,
yeah.
It's obviously got to be Ben Affleck, but even if it wasn't already predetermined to be Affleck, I think based on what you've seen him do, like with Argo,
that's what I was
thinking.
Think
he could handle that.
I was thinking the exact same thing. The Argo connection would be great for him to direct that. Yeah. Matthew, what about you?
Terry Gilliam.
Oh, interesting.
Just because of the weirdness, bizarreness of it?
Well, yeah, but it kind of fits his sort of his general je ne sais quoi.
Yeah.
His joie de vivre, his avec moi. You know, the whole
random
shtick.
French words that you can throw out. Yeah, yeah.
Is voulez-vous coucher avec moi? No, it's the whole, I don't know. It feels like something that's perfectly suited to his sensibility, especially... Mm. If, you know, if we're talking like Brazil era Terry, where he doesn't have to worry about
logic.
Yeah.
He almost directed Harry Potter, that first movie.
Right. Ooh. But
and it's tragic that that never happened.
What a world just, that would be.
There's
and, right?
something about that. He combines that technique with that Monty Python sort of we are going to skewer everything, but it's not going to be overt, goofy satire. It's going to be something where you look at every aspect of it and go, my God, I never saw that. I never thought about that until right now.
All right.
You know what's interesting? If Terry Gilliam had directed Harry Potter, everything would be different except for who plays that ghost.
True. Very true.
Took Matthew a little bit of time to get that. let's see. Who did we miss? Did we get everybody on Death in the Family?
I don't think I did.
Oh, Rodrigo, what do you have?
I would do Kenneth Branagh.
Big family, nice. Epic, sprawling soliloquies with the Joker and Batman.
It's Hamlet, you know, or Richard III or something like that. Yeah. I mean, you want that gravitas when you're like holding somebody who's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the final one, probably the most recent of all of these, Court of Owls. Court of Owls, Matthew.
I think that Court of Owls should be directed by the kid who did that thing. What was his name?
Who directed Seven?
All I know about that movie is Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt screaming about a box.
I'm looking it up right now. Da, 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 da. It's Fincher. I said Fincher already.
All right. Well, I'm going to have him direct two Batman movies because he's so good. He will direct Court of Owls for me. Matthew, what do you have for Court of Owls?
You got a big, weird, dark conspiracy kind of thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man.
Fincher seems like the best choice.
I think that it should be written by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, there you go.
Because no one can write politics like Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, there you go.
But I would give it to Damon Lindelof to direct or be a part of in some way because of all his work on Lost. Because I think it's a very similar sort of thing with, you know, like large sprawling conspiracy, a bunch of reveals that feel like they came out of nowhere and weren't really planned, but everyone insisted that they were planned the entire time, and a gigantic cast. So I think it'd be interesting.
If he were still alive, maybe Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, that's a good one.
That would be very good. I'm going to give it to Ava DuVernay.
Who is that?
Ava DuVernay?
Yeah.
She did Selma, didn't she? She did Straight Outta Compton.
All right, cool. Rodrigo, what about you? Court of Owls.
I would give it to Lars von Trier. And the reason for that is that I spent a lot of money on film school just so I can throw out Lars von Trier every once in a while.
Yep.
So definitely.
You know, that's the second Lars von Trier reference of the night, by the way. Not in this show, but.
Oh, really? Oh, that's. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you guys did Zach on film.
Yeah, we did
before,
Zach on film.
Yeah.
Speaking of Zach on film, quick plug, One Crazy Summer this Friday, Zach on film.
Yeah.
Run crazy.
Good job, everyone, on maintaining the pretentious side of that show, even when I'm not around.
Okay. Anything else? Anything else we want to touch on? We have just a few minutes left, I think.
I have a thing.
Okay. Quickly.
Today is October the 4th. 10 years ago today, I wrote my first work for Major Spoilers.
Hey, there you go.
It was a review of Ultimates 2, number 12. It was a god-awful comic.
There you go.
I want to encourage everyone, if they haven't, to go and check out the Series of Unfortunate Events trailer that Netflix dropped, because it's so cool. And it looks way better than the movie. Oh, yeah. And Lemony Snicket, in quotes, yeah, it's the series, is the only person in the advert. But you hear Neil Patrick Harris laughing.
I love Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, he's Count Olaf. The bad guy.
Oh.
With the eyebrows.
He's the music master, you know.
I've heard.
What else have you heard about Neil Patrick Harris and Supergirl Flash crossovers?
Nothing about Neil Patrick Harris.
Darn it.
I haven't seen the crossovers. I've only seen the premieres.
Yeah. Cannot wait. I want to watch all the premieres this year. I'm super excited.
I've seen the Instagram posts.
Oh. Well, one thing we haven't talked about, though, that I'm super excited about is the Dominator storyline coming in the 4-part crossover event on the CW shows this year. It's going to happen. And
I know, but I want to make my joke and I can't make it now.
Why not?
Dominator, I hardly know her.
Okay.
See, creepy.
That's a classic.
Yeah, that's a classic Matthew right there.
But classic Sunstone, more like.
Yeah, here it actually works.
Here's the thing. So we don't have time to talk about it this week, but next week on the Major Spoilers podcast, we're going to take a look at the 3-part story arc. It's really event that's spanned into, you know, a billion different comics. We're going to be taking a look at Invasion, the 3-part story from DC Comics in, 1988, 87, something like that, 87?
I think it was 87 into 88.
Yeah. I just remember that was an early time of me reading comics and discovering things. I was like, what is this giant 80-page giant? And why is there a reference to it in Aquaman? What's going on? Why is Batman not in the hospital? Anyway, we're going to be talking about that next time on the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you, everyone, for downloading and listening, being part of the Major Spoilers experience. Invasion next week. Why? Because we know that you love comics, and we do, too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books, or I'll kill you. your Steve Rogers shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. And I don't care if Spider-Man's a clone.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.